Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're the place that unlocks complex info so you can, well, get up to speed fast.
Yeah.
Today, we're really getting into the world of oil and gas, how we get it, who's in charge, and what happens when you mix immense physical force with, let's say, intense global politics. We're looking at this through an engineer's perspective based on some fantastic source material called oil and water.
Yeah, exactly. And our mission today is really to take you, the listener, beyond just the headlines. We want to get into the, you know, the nuts and bolts, the geopolitics, and the actual human experience of this huge industry. Yeah. And that title, Oil and Water, it's sort of the perfect metaphor, isn't it? You've got all these entities, countries, companies, different goals.
Yeah.
All forced together, but they don't naturally mix. They don't really get along.
Right. And that tension, you see it right away with life on these offshore platforms described in the sources. You might picture something really basic, maybe grim. But they actually call the living quarters a five-star hotel.
Oh, absolutely. They really have to be, you know?
Yeah.
To get the kind of specialized skills you need out there, you've got to offset the isolation and, frankly, the danger with really good amenities. We're talking huge buffets, food available literally 24/7.
Unlimited food sounds okay.
It does. And the detail that really jumped out at me from the source, 17 different types of Indian pickle jars just available.
I mean, wow.
Yeah. Plus gyms, media rooms, doctors on call all the time. It's designed to be this comfortable bubble.
But then there's the flip side. The work itself, 12 hours a day, every day, for two solid weeks.
Exactly. 14 days on, then 14 days off. That 14-14 rotation, it's like it embodies that oil and water conflict inside the person doing the work. You're paid well, we're comfortable. But the sources mention some people feeling like they don't quite belong anywhere, not really on the platform, not quite back home either.
Creates a kind of permanent dislocation.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. And that dislocation, it's kind of necessary because the stakes involved in the work are just incredibly high. Let's talk about the engineering scale for a minute. We're focusing on the Mumbai High Field offshore. The drilling itself starts about 75 meters below the sea surface. Okay, that's deep already. But then you have to go down another 1.3 to maybe 2 kilometers under the seabed to actually reach the oil and gas.
2 kilometers of solid rock drilled from a platform floating in the ocean. That's mind-boggling. It feels like you're trying to control this this barely contained genie, right? Like under insane pressure, what did the source say? Around 2,000 PSI, pounds per square inch down
it's
there.
It's typically, around 2,000 PSI.
And you think, my car tires maybe, 45 PSI?
Exactly. So 2,000 PSI is, well, it's terrifying if it gets loose.
So how do you even start? How do you get stable enough to drill?
Right. So first step is getting the platform itself secured. Use these enormous things called jack-up rigs. They literally float out to the location, drop these massive legs down to the seabed, anchor themselves, and then using huge motors, they jack the whole platform up maybe 15 meters clear of the sea level.
Okay, so now you have a stable base way above the waves. Then the drilling starts.
Then the drilling. With specialized drill tips, sometimes coated with industrial diamonds, believe it or not, to cut through all that rock.
And the biggest fear must be that blowout, right? Where the pressure wins and oil just shoots everywhere, like 100 meters high.
Yeah.
We hear about the blowout preventer, the BOP, on the surface, but what stops it way down deep?
Yeah, the BOP is critical, but the real safety net, the ultimate one, is much deeper. It's called the subsurface safety valve, or SSSV. It sits about 30 meters below the seabed. Think of it as this deeply buried emergency brake.
30 meters below the seabed. Okay. And how does that work? How's it controlled from the platform?
Well, this is where the engineering gets really clever and focuses on reliability. That SSSV, it's actually held open by hydraulic pressure, about 2,000 PSI, same as the well. And this pressure is delivered through this tiny little tube, like a quarter inch wide, running all the way down from the platform.
Tiny tube controlling that massive pressure.
Yes. And the genius is it's designed to fail safe.
Yeah.
If anything cuts that pressure, say the platform gets hit or the tube breaks, the hydraulic pressure drops and powerful springs automatically slam the valve shut instantly.
Ah, so it needs constant energy, constant pressure just to stay open. If that fails, it defaults to closed.
Precisely. Fail safe. And then back up on the surface, you also have the surface safety valve, the SSV. That one needs pneumatic, like air pressure,
right,
to stay open. You absolutely need both valves open at the same time for anything to flow out.
Layers of safety.
Layers. And here's something really counterintuitive from the source material, considering the volumes we're talking about. Even though these wells produce thousands of barrels a day, the actual opening the oil and gas flows through because of that immense pressure. it's often only 1 or 2 centimeters wide.
1 or 2 centimeters. That's it. That just shows how powerful that pressure is.
It really does. The whole system is incredibly sensitive.
And that sensitivity, it leads to some interesting human dynamics too, right? There was that story in The Source about trust and a faulty pump.
Oh, yeah. That was a great example. This main oil line pump kept tripping, cutting their production by half. Huge problem. And the crew, they couldn't find the cause. So naturally, suspicion starts falling on people. Maybe someone's doing it deliberately. Sabotage.
Because the stakes are so high.
Exactly. It's that oil and water thing. Again, technical problem immediately becomes a human trust issue. But this one instrumentation engineer, he suspected something else. He figured out it was a faulty pressure switch. The switch was sending this incredibly brief signal, just a tiny spike, too fast for the main control system logs to even record it properly.
So the computers looked fine. But the physical pump was still reacting to this ghost signal.
Right. It was tripping the pump, causing chaos and suspicion. He had to set up this simple relay trap, basically, to physically catch the signal and prove it was the switch. That diagnosis, finding that tiny electrical glitch, it basically saved the team's morale and restored trust.
Just shows how one tiny component failing can ripple through everything in that kind of environment.
Absolutely. It underlines the intense reliance on every single piece of equipment and on each other.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit. From the single rig to the global picture, technology is really changing the game in terms of supply, isn't it? Mostly driven by geology meeting politics, which, again, don't mix well. The big one here is fracking, hydraulic fracturing.
Right. Fracking's different. You're not just tapping into a big underground pool of oil or gas that's already under pressure. You're going after resources trapped inside layers of rock, like the Marcellus Shale Formation in the U.S. The process is pretty intense. You drill down vertically, maybe a couple of kilometers, then you turn and drill horizontally, sometimes for thousands of meters, right through that rock layer, and then you pump in fluid, mostly water, sand, and some chemicals at incredibly high pressure.
How high are we talking?
Can be up to 10,000 PSI, way higher than conventional drilling. This fractures the rock, hence the name, and lets the trapped gas or oil flow out.
And the impact on global energy politics has been, well, huge.
Oh, absolutely staggering. Fracking is the main reason the U.S. has become the world's biggest producer of crude oil recently. And that directly challenges the traditional powerhouses, like OPEC.
How does that play out? Does OPEC fight back?
They do, using price. OPEC countries, especially Saudi Arabia, can often produce oil very cheaply, maybe $10 a barrel profitably. They aim for market prices around, say, $60 a barrel generally. But if they want to hurt U.S. fracking producers who have higher costs, they can flood the market, drive the price way down, and suddenly fracking isn't economically viable anymore. It's using price as a geopolitical weapon.
But fracking itself isn't without major issues, right? It's another one of those oil and water conflicts, pitting energy independence against local environmental costs.
Definitely. It comes with a heavy price tag locally. First, it uses vastly more water than traditional drilling, maybe 100 times more per well. Second, the wastewater that comes back up is pretty toxic stuff, full of chemicals, and disposal is a real challenge. And third, yes, the process of injecting fluid at such high pressure has been linked to causing small earthquakes in some areas.
And wasn't there that issue with, like, flammable tap water near fracking sites?
Yes, that's happened. Methane gas migrating into local water wells. It paints a pretty unsettling picture, you know. Supply goes up, but for people living nearby, the quality of life can definitely go down.
That kind of contradiction, where vast resource wealth doesn't translate into prosperity, it seems even starker in some countries. The whole natural resource curse idea, sometimes called the Dutch disease. Venezuela comes to mind from the source material.
Yeah, Venezuela is the classic tragic example. It has the world's largest proven oil reserves, over 300 billion barrels. That's more than Saudi Arabia.
More than Saudi Arabia, wow.
And yet, the country's economy is shattered. People face terrible hardship. Inflation hit, what was it, 60,000% in 2018? Just catastrophic. The curse kicks in because having all that wealth concentrated in one resource, it makes it easier for authoritarian regimes to control the national income.
And the Dutch disease part, how does that fit in? I know it refers back to the Netherlands finding natural gas.
Right. It happens because the huge influx of oil money strengthens the country's currency dramatically, makes it really valuable. But a super strong currency makes everything else produced in the country, farming, manufacturing, too expensive to export or compete internationally. So other industries wither. The leaders don't diversify, they might waste the oil money on flashy projects, and the population suffers because the economy becomes totally dependent on that one resource, controlled by a few.
So oil is the big financial lever. But natural gas seems to be increasingly used as a direct political weapon, especially thinking about Russia and Europe.
Absolutely. Russia has shown repeatedly it's willing to use its control over gas pipelines as leverage. Cutting supplies to Ukraine is a prime example. And this competition extends to literally claiming the territory where future resources might lie. Look at the Arctic.
Yeah, the estimates are huge, right? Like a quarter of the world's undiscovered oil and gas?
Something like that. So you have nations basically scrambling to stake their claims over huge underwater territories. The most dramatic example was that Russian flag planting stunt in 2007.
Oh, right. Sending submarines down.
Exactly. Two manned subs went down over 4 kilometers to the seabed under the North Pole. And they planted a Russian flag made of rust-proof titanium on the Lomonosov Ridge. The intent was clearly to bolster their claim to like 450,000 square kilometers of the Arctic shelf.
How did other countries react?
With outrage, pretty much. Canada's foreign minister famously said something like, "This isn't the 15th century. You can't just go around planting flags."
Hmm.
But it shows how determined nations are to secure these future resources. It's a preview of, well, future conflicts, potentially.
Given all these problems, the environmental costs, the geopolitical instability, why aren't we moving faster to alternatives? The source material brings it back to basic physics, right? Energy density.
Yeah, it's a fundamental challenge. Physics doesn't really care about politics. Take 50 kilograms of gasoline.
Okay.
Compare the energy it holds to 50 kilograms of even the best current battery technology. The gasoline just packs in vastly, vastly more energy. It's incredibly dense.
So that density makes it hard to replace, even though burning it is inefficient.
Right. Burning gasoline in an engine, you lose something like 70% of its energy potential as waste heat. It's terribly inefficient in that sense. Electric motors using batteries, they're over 95% efficient at converting stored energy into motion. Much better. But storing enough energy in the battery is the bottleneck.
So we're stuck with this polluting, dense fuel.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to that half-angel, half-devil idea from the source. Oil isn't purely bad.
No, it's complicated. Crude oil has had some undeniably positive impacts. Think about medical equipment, the specialized plastics needed in incubators to save premature babies. That material comes from crude oil derivatives.
I haven't thought of that.
And historically, there's a strong argument that the rise of kerosene from crude oil in the 19th century basically saved the whales. It replaced whale oil as the main fuel for lamps, just as whaling was pushing many species towards extinction.
Save the whales. That's a pretty significant angel point. Okay, so if oil is the mixed bag, the half-devil, what's the ultimate angel energy source people talk about? Nuclear fusion.
Fusion is often held up as the holy grail, yeah. But it's important to be clear, fusion is not the same as the nuclear fission we use today.
Right. Fission is splitting heavy atoms, like uranium.
Mm-hmm.
That generates power, but also leaves behind that dangerous, long-lasting radioactive waste.
Exactly. Fusion is the opposite. It's fusing light atoms together, usually isotopes of hydrogen, like deuterium and tritium. That's what powers the sun. The potential benefits are huge. It's inherently safer. The main byproduct is just harmless helium gas. And it releases even more energy per reaction than fission, maybe 4 or 5 times as much.
Sounds almost too good to be true. What's the catch? Why don't we have fusion reactors everywhere?
The catch is it's incredibly difficult to do. You have to replicate the conditions inside the sun right here on Earth. We're talking temperatures of around 100 million degrees Celsius, plus immense pressure just to get the atoms to fuse. Containing that reaction is the monumental challenge.
And the global effort to crack this is enormous, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. Look at the ITER project down in France. It's this massive international collaboration, 35 countries involved, costing upwards of $20 billion. But here's the thing. ITER isn't even designed to generate electricity. Its goal is purely scientific fronts. Prove that controlled fusion on a large scale is possible. Generate knowledge.
So it's a giant experiment,
yeah.
Basically. Not a power plant yet.
Not yet. And it's taking decades. Meanwhile, you've got private companies trying different approaches, hoping to get there faster.
Like that company mentioned, TriAlpha Energy, what are they doing differently?
They're exploring alternative fuel cycles, maybe using boron, which is more abundant, and aiming for smaller reactor designs, maybe even house-sized eventually. They're talking about ambitious goals, like achieving a 20 times energy return on investment. If they, or someone like them, can crack the containment and ignition problem.
Then the whole energy landscape changes.
Completely. The geopolitical fights over oil and gas reserves, they could become almost irrelevant overnight. It would be a total paradigm shift.
That's the optimistic future. But right now, today, we're still firmly in that oil and water reality. The global energy system is just full of these clashing forces, isn't it? Nations competing, companies battling, the environment versus the economy.
Yeah, they just don't mix easily. Fossil fuels really do sit in that uncomfortable spot, maybe a necessary evil, that half angel, half devil. Mm-hmm. And the sheer complexity involved just keeping things running, you know, from tiny clearances and a high-speed turbine to those deep-sea fail-safes. It's really an engineering marvel.
It really is. And that brings us to a final thought, kind of circling back to the engineers themselves. The source material talks about the deep satisfaction they get from making these incredibly complex systems work. They compared pushing oil and gas through pipes to, like, sending data through fiber optics.
Yeah, managing complexity is its own reward, I think.
Right. And it made me think, you have visionaries like Nikola Tesla, who dreamed of giving the world free, unlimited electricity, the super elegant, simple ideal. But then you look at the reality described in the source, starting up a big compressor system involving a Rolls-Royce engine, a turbine, a compressor. It's this intricate 5-hour multi-stage process. So the question for you, the listener, might be, does the satisfaction for an engineer come just from finding a solution, maybe the elegant one? Or is there something compelling about tackling the sheer scale, the difficulty, the massive, messy complexity of a problem like energy? Something to think about maybe next time you flip a switch.